Most certainly was, I told him, and it looked horribly stretched. We could now see the granular red mass of the tumour over which the right optic nerve, a pale white band a few millimetres in width, was tightly splayed. "I think I'd better take over now," I said. "I'm sorry, but what with the baby and her eyesight being so bad, it's not really a training case." "Of course," said Patrick, and he climbed out of the operating chair and I took his place. I quickly cut into the tumour to the left of the optic nerve, and to my relief, the tumour was soft and sucked easily. Admittedly, most supracellar tumours do. It did not take long to debulk the tumour with the sucker in my right hand and the diathermy forceps in my left. I gradually eased the hollowed-out tumour away from the optic nerves. The tumour was not stuck to the optic nerves, and after an hour or so we had a spectacular view of both right and left optic nerves and their junction, known as the chiasm. They look like a pair of miniature white trousers, although thin and stretched, because of the tumour which I had now removed. On either side were the great carotid arteries that supply most of the blood to the brain, and further back the pituitary stalk, the fragile structure that connects the all-important pea-sized pituitary gland to the brain, which coordinates all the body's hormonal systems. It sits in a little cavity known as the cella, just beneath the optic nerves, which is why Melanie's tumour is called a supracellar meningioma. "All out! Let's close up quick, and the obstetricians can do the C-section," I announced to the assembled audience. I muttered in an aside to Patrick that I hoped to God that her eyesight would recover. So Patrick and I closed up Melanie's head and left our colleagues to get on with delivering the baby. As we walked out of the theatre, the paediatricians passed us, wheeling a paediatric ventilator and resuscitation equipment into the room. I went off to get a cup of coffee and get some paperwork done in my office. Patrick stayed behind to watch the caesarean section. He rang me an hour later. I was sitting at my desk dictating letters. "It all went fine. She's on the ITU and the baby's next to her." "Can she see?" I asked. "Too early to say," Patrick said. "Her pupils are a bit slow." I felt a familiar drag of fear in my stomach. The fact that the pupils of her eyes were not reacting properly to light might just be a temporary anaesthetic effect, but it could also mean that the nerves were irreparably damaged and that she was completely blind, even though the operation had seemed to go so well. "We'll have to wait and see," I replied. "The next patient's on the table," Patrick said. "Shall we start?" I left my office to go and join him. The second patient on the list was a woman in her 50s with a malignant left temporal glioma, a cancerous tumour of the brain itself. I had seen her a week earlier in my outpatient clinic. She had come with her husband, and they held each other's hands as they told me how she had become confused and forgetful over the preceding weeks. I explained to them that her brain scan showed what was undoubtedly a malignant tumour. "My father died from a malignant brain tumour," she told me. "It was terrible to watch him deteriorate and die, and I thought that if that happened to me, I would not want to be treated." "The trouble is," I said reluctantly, "it will happen to you anyway. If I treat you, with a bit of luck, you might have some years of reasonable life. But if we do nothing, you have only a few months left to live." In reality, this was probably optimistic. The scan showed a foul, malignant tumour in her dominant temporal lobe, dominant meaning the half of the brain responsible for speech and language, that was already growing deep into her brain. It was unlikely that she had more than a few months left to live, whatever I did, but there is always hope, and there are always a few patients, sadly only a small minority, who are statistical outliers and defy the averages to live for several years. We had agreed that we should operate. Patrick did most of it, and I assisted him. The operation went well enough, though as soon as Patrick drilled open her head and cut through the meninges, we could see that the tumour was already spreading widely, more widely than in the brain scan done only 2 weeks earlier. We removed as much of the tumour as we safely could, tangled as it was with the distal branches of the left middle cerebral artery. I did not think we had done her any serious harm, though, nor had we done her much good. "What's her prognosis, boss?" Patrick asked me as he stitched the dura, and I cut his stitches with a pair of scissors. "A few months, probably," I replied. I told him about her father and what she had said to me. "It's difficult to do nothing," I said. "But death is not always a bad outcome, you know, and a quick death can be better than a slow one." Patrick said nothing as he continued to close the woman's meninges with his sutures. Sometimes I discuss with my neurosurgical colleagues what we would do if we, as neurosurgeons, and without any illusions about how little treatment achieves, were diagnosed with a malignant brain tumour. I usually say that I hope that I would commit suicide, but you never know for certain what you will decide until it happens. As we stitched her head up, I did not expect any problems. Judith took her round on her trolley, pushed by one of the ODAs and nurses to the ITU, while I sat down and wrote an operating note. A few minutes later, Judith put her head round the theatre door. "Henry, she's not waking up, and her left pupil is bigger than her right. What do you want to do?" I swore quietly and quickly walked the short distance to the intensive care unit. In the corner of the room, I could see Melanie and a baby's cot beside her bed, but I hurried past to look at the second patient. With one hand, I gently opened her eyelids. The left pupil was large and black, as large as a saucer. "You better scan her," I said to Patrick, who had come hurrying up when he had heard the news. Judith was already re-anaesthetizing the woman, putting a tube down into her lungs so as to put her back on a ventilator. I told Patrick to tell the staff in the scanner that we would be bringing her for a scan immediately and never mind what else they were doing. I wasn't going to wait for a porter. Patrick went to the nurse's desk and picked up the phone, while Judith and the nurses disconnected the woman from all the monitoring equipment behind her and, with my help, wheeled her quickly out of the ITU to take her to the CT scanner. Together with the radiographer, we quickly slid her into the machine. I walked back to the control room with its leaded X-ray-proof window looking out into the room where the patient lay with her head in the scanner. Impatient and anxious, I watched the transverse slices of the scan appear on the computer monitor, gradually working their way up towards where I had been operating. The scan showed a huge hemorrhage deep in her brain, on the side of the operation, although slightly separate from it. It was clearly both inoperable and fatal. A post-operative intracerebral hemorrhage, a rare but recognized complication of such surgery. I picked up the phone in the control room and rang her husband. "I'm afraid I have rather bad news for you," I said. I went round to the surgical sitting room, and I lay on the sofa, staring at the sky through the high windows, waiting for her husband and daughter to arrive. I spoke to them an hour later in the little interview room on the ITU. They collapsed into each other's arms in tears. Dressed in my theatre pyjama suit, I looked on miserably. As she was going to die, the nurses had moved her into a side room where she lay on her own. I took her husband and daughter to see her. They sat down beside her. She was unconscious and mute, her eyes closed, with a lopsided bandage around her head, beneath which her bloodied hair hung down. The ventilator, which was keeping her alive, gently sighed beside her. "Are you really sure she cannot hear anything we say to her?" her daughter asked me. I told her that she was in a deep coma, but that even if she could hear, she would not understand what she heard, since the hemorrhage was directly in the speech area of her brain. "And